the fishing lures. I love the plumber's snakes. I love the things that people make.
Hello, you are listening to These Things That People Make on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. My name is Sarah, I'm your host, and I'm excited about today's show. I had the pleasure last Sunday of meeting up at Sonic Cafe on Cecil Street in Toronto. Really nice coffee. Hadn't had coffee that good in a long time, and I met with Jesse and Charlie Huskin, who... Charlie is the founder of the St. The Rules Dale Library, and Jesse is his junior partner and also his son. And the St. The Rules Dale Library is an independent bookstore that's been around in Toronto since 1979 and recently closed their doors because of a, you know, basically because of gentrification. But we're going to get into more details about that. And who knows, maybe it will open again or maybe it will show up in another form. Its last home was on 86 Nassau Street in Kensington Market. And it was in two other locations in Toronto before that. But I'm going to just let Charlie sort of tell the story from the beginning.
My name is Charlie Huskin, and I'm the founder of the St. The Rosedale Library. In 1979, I was working at a place called The Bookseller, which was a small three-location family kind of chain. And I was made the buyer late winter, early spring, but I really didn't have the kind of freedom that I wanted to organize events and also to bring in the kind of stock that I wanted. But I did have some fun. The poet Victor Coleman gave me Allen Ginsberg's phone number, and I knew he was coming to town to do a reading at Convocation Hall, so I arranged for him to do a signing, and that was pretty exciting for a 29-year-old guy. And I also organized a dual book launch with an unlikely combination, Kathy Acker and Paul Quarrington. And again, you know, that was fun because I admired their work, even though I knew it was so different from each other and also would have a completely different readership. But by summer's end, the family had decided to do away with that particular location, which was right on Yonge Street and the most interesting, I thought, of the three stores. And they hired a general manager who, quite frankly, was a bozo. And he was bringing in remainders that had been, you know, circulating for years. But he didn't know the book trade that well, so it looked all exciting to him, whereas it looked really stale to me. So I was helping unload this, you know, cube van full of remainders of stuff that was kind of boring. And I kept taking washroom breaks over and over to get away from him because he was into positive thinking. So he was playing the theme from Star Wars really loud to try to get the staff excited. And I thought, I'm working for an idiot. And this whole place may be owned by an asshole. So I thought, if I'm going to work for an asshole, it might as well be this asshole. And I'm, for the radio audience, I'm pointing at myself. So I phoned Jesse's mom and I said, I'm going to do a crazy thing. I'm going to give notice today. And she was fully supportive of that and gave notice and then started to make plans to open a bookstore because I knew of a likely location. There was a bargain remainder store on Queen next to a record store, and it wasn't a great fit. with the kind of books that he was offering and the record store. But I knew that we could probably do some exciting stuff, you know, linking rock and roll and literature. So I did that. I signed the lease with, actually it was the Mafia. So I came up with 1 month's rent, and then they looked at me and they said, this isn't enough. And I thought, what do they mean? Because this is all my savings. And they said, we have to have last month's rent. So I immediately went into debt. So I've been in debt, you know, since 1979 to keep this thing going. And you don't pay mafioso late. So I knew that that was actually maybe going to work for my benefit, that I would always be kind of on the hustle. But it was actually a beautiful golden opportunity, because mainstream bookstores weren't stocking things like Patti Smith, had never heard of Jim Carroll, thought that Jim Morrison was dead in all senses. John Lennon was a big shrug, like, oh, he's just a pop guy. And so we brought in poetry books by writers that I knew and admired, as well as the more approachable pop stuff that I refer to as gateway writers, so that somebody who read, say, Patti Smith, we could say, well, try reading Frank O'Hara, or try reading, you know, some of the Beats or whatever. But then the Beats and people like Hunter S. Thompson, they generated their own legends. One didn't have to work too hard to make that leap. So we were next to the record store for about a year and a half and got a better location across the street. So that was 81, and then we moved in 86 to the corner of Church Wellesley, because Queen East wasn't developing the way Queen West was, so we were looking for a change. And there we were, two straight guys running a bookstore in the middle of the new gay epicenter. And we were wondering how that was going to work out, and we were embraced with open arms, and stayed there for 22 years. And it was a happy arrangement until, you know, really gentrification kind of started kicking in all over the city, but I think especially at the corner of Church Wellesley. We knew that things were really turning odd when the president of the BIA, the Business Improvement Association, Dennis O'Connor, he ran a gallery, an art gallery, and their mandate was to show gay and lesbian art. So one would think, well, they're suited for Church Wellesley, and he's the head of the Business Improvement Association. Well, he moved his art gallery to Parliament and Queen during his tenure as the BIA president. And it's funny, because when we decided to move out of the neighborhood, people were saying, why? We said, well, don't ask us, talk to Dennis, you know, like he's, you know, one of the main people providing culture to the neighborhood. Talk to him, or talk to both of us, but don't just, you know, isolate us by saying, you know, that our move is, you know, overly significant or something. But then we moved to 86 Nassau, and that's become an unhappy story. We were locked out by the bailiffs the weekend of June 19, and we're still trying to negotiate with the landlady, but that's quite difficult. We have a friendly lawyer working for us. The bailiffs are actually on side, but yeah, it's become a kind of unhappy story about a relationship, a business relationship gone completely sour. So here we are today.
Here we are. And that's June, we're talking just like 2 months ago.
2 months ago.
Yeah.
Don't go.
You are listening to These Things That People Make on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. And I'm airing an interview I did about the St. The Rosedale Library and the history of that bookstore in Toronto. You heard Charlie Huskin's voice, and you will also hear his junior partner Jesse's voice in the next part of the interview. That part of the interview just heard Charlie talked a little bit about how the bookstore got started, thinking about the role of events and speaking series and thinking about the role of providing really good choices of books in a satisfying way. So Charlie opened a bookstore in 1979, instantly went into debt, which is also kind of the song of the independent bookstores. And we're going to go to the next part of the interview now.
The bookstore is sort of at a standstill right now.
Yeah, I'd say so. But, you know, the heart of the bookstore is still beating.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're still, you know, and that's true not just for us. I'm now working with Mark Lastman and Judy Wolf on a cultural event series called This Is Not a Reading Series. And those people used to own and operate Page's Bookstore. And the thing is, if you get it into your system, your blood, you know, it's hard to give up book selling because for us it's more than retailing. It's in some ways literary curating.
Well, and there's also the side of being a reader, which is this, you know, the city's lacks a lot of opportunities for readers in terms of bookstores now.
Yeah.
So regardless of bookselling, you can approach it that way and wonder.
Yeah. Talk about Vanessa
Place. Where do you buy the books that you love in the city? There are lots of great bookstores, but not good stores for art books, not good stores for modern literary classics, not good stores for zines, consignment items, no good stores for philosophy or cultural theory. So there's a void in the city for readers. So
yeah, and it's a little embarrassing. For example, the people at the Toronto New School of Writing, they've invited Vanessa Place and Joanne Kiger to do workshops, and you can maybe find as a bargain books by Joanne Kiger. Because she was published by Penguin, one of the major houses, and they did this stupid instant remaindering kind of thing where they suddenly glut the market with these copies of her books with magic marker slashes on them. But her big collection is done by a very small press out of Maine in the States, and available through a distributor that no one in the city deals with. We did. So here she is. She's coming to town. Sadly, Joanne Kiger is a poet of note, but in terms of like publicity in Toronto, she'll often be referred to as Gary Snyder's ex. Gary Snyder, the author of Turtle Island, which won a Pulitzer. But, you know, she's the peer of all that generation of writers. And, a woman of note, a poet of note. And then you can't find copies of that big collection by her.
Yeah.
Same with Vanessa Place. She's coming to town. She's a founder of a press called Les Figues.
She's an author who's written two books, which have never really been accessible in Toronto, with the exception of our store and Pages, but which are nonetheless very important. And really enthusiastically championed on the internet, on people's blogs, in bookstores in the U.S. And so, I mean, part of my whole interest in jumping aboard the store was in seeing this massive void, having difficulty even just buying things that I was interested in and that I could talk about with people who traveled more frequently or who used to work in the U.S. or, you know, specifically seeing people's blogs and discussion on the internet and seeing none of these books available. So it just seemed like a kind of like, there is really a deep void in Toronto that, small businesses are having trouble filling because of the landscape. And certainly the Arts Councils have never had any interest in distribution or anything as, you know, as, you know, abject and practical as distribution is really off their radar. They're really only interested in things that might contribute to a really grandiose idea of Canadian cultural life.
But what is that? I'm kind of confused because, I mean, of course, I mean, it's not that confusing, but Toronto tangibly, visibly has a lot of money and a lot of seemingly interest in the arts. And we have the Toronto Women's Bookstore, we have Glad Day Books, we have Pages, and we have the St. Rosa Library, all, like, struggling to stay not completely in debt, you know? I'm a bit baffled by where the priorities are. I just don't really understand.
Well, I think the easy answer to your question, or the way I would answer it, is, you know, the emphasis on spectacle is the only, certainly the only way that finance capital, which is what Toronto is all about, can feel like it's spent its money right. They were dumping money into, you know, small literary festivals, there would be no spectacle. I mean, there wouldn't be, you know, there certainly wouldn't be an entertainment value of the kind of really base level that is expected. And even from art these days, the expectations are that there'll be a spectacle that will, you know, enter the news media and maybe turn up somewhere, draw some kind of cultural attention to a city, whereas the kind of, like, you know, it wouldn't be, you know, as exciting to create Toronto as a great city for small press poetry, you know, or a great city for, these things don't really draw people in a kind of, like, they don't draw in tourists in the way that spectacles do. So the financial money will never go in that direction. It just never will. It would require visionary individuals with wealth, as opposed to institutions who have a different mandate. I mean, with that, having said that, there's the Scream in High Park, which presumably does, you know, draw some attention to Toronto. And so maybe I'm being too cynical, but that would be my answer.
Plus, I don't know. I also think the problem in Toronto is that the culture here is young in a way. And Toronto never really experienced modernism the way that even, say, cities like Chicago or even some of the, say, cities in Latin America experienced. In Toronto, there was a Victorian, Edwardian sensibility. You know, no poem was a poem unless it was rhyming couplets or, you know, or maybe popular in the way that Cremation of Sam McGee is popular. Everything else was off the radar. Anybody who wanted to write modernist poetry would get out of Canada and hang out in New York or Paris or wherever. I mean, you know, people were saying, you know, like, you know, already in the 70s, like, you know, this thing about Toronto is a world-class city. I don't know. I came here in 71, 72, and I found Toronto comfortable. That's why I settled here, not because it was a world-class city. I mean, the first time I went to the Art Gallery of Ontario, I cried. It was so pathetic. It was.
What did you see?
Not much. You know, Dutch painting from, you know, who cares when, you know?
If only. It wasn't even Dutch painting. It was pre-Columbus.
Yeah. Well, now the Art Gallery of Ontario costs $20.
I know. See, that's a sign of its provincialism as well. Yeah. You know, $20 to see what, you know?
Yeah. Listening to These Things That People Make on CFRU 93.3 FM. In the background, one of my favorite bands that I forgot about and then remembered about,
Penguin Cafe Orchestra. Found them in the vinyl library at CFRU recently. I'm going to try to only play vinyl on the radio show for a while. I'm airing an interview with Charlie and Jesse Huskin of the Santa Rosa Library. Sadly, the Santa Rosa Library in June closed its doors due to a dispute between a landlord who wanted a lot of money to keep this store going in its location in Kensington Market. And we're talking about book culture, we're talking about distribution, we're talking about how do you consider culture, what do you value in your city, and what do you want to see, and how a lot of cities these days are trying to merge arts funding and tourism funding in a really big way, which really lends itself to want to make things big and spectacular and sometimes less interesting or sometimes less valuable, especially for the people who live in the city. We're going to go to the last part of the interview now.
What it's all about is maintenance of a status quo and satisfying the insurance brokers here in town, or, you know, that kind of Bay Street sensibility. It's pathetic. I'm sorry. I grew up in the States in a farming community, and we had more access to visual culture because we were within driving distance of the Walker Art Center. And I spent a summer living with my brother in Philadelphia, and on rainy days we'd go to the Philadelphia Art Museum and muse on Marcel Duchamp's Large Glass. That's 20th century art. Mm-hmm. Well, where are the major pieces of 20th century art in Toronto? You know, there are some great things by Canadians. You know, Painter's 11, I think, is underestimated as a cultural force. They used to hang a bit here at Grossman's Tavern. But even after that, you know, Graham Cofftree is a great painter, and he lived not far from here. We're on Cecil Street near Grossman's Tavern. And when he died, a collection had to be taken to bury him in a cardboard coffin. That's not right. So we're not the first to suffer, you know, in this city. Because we were around for 30 years as a public space, we kind of went down, and then it suddenly makes the news. But there have been some of these kind of sad stories for some time now, but no one's paying attention to them as long as the star system works. Because whenever I point out these kinds of problems, people say in the literary world, especially the journalists, get all defensive. You know, and they say, well, we've got Margaret Atwood, and we've got Michael Ondaatje, which is great. Uh-huh. But they are the exceptions that prove the rule that this city, because of its kind of bourgeois Bay Street sensibility, emphasizes the object, or in this case, the star, rather than create a process. And I was mentored by a painter, Tom Hodgson, a member of Painters 11, and he would just almost bang the table over and over saying, you know, don't overemphasize skill and don't overemphasize the object, you know, process is what to him it was all about. So he was one of the few people who, you know, could stand up to it because he was such a colorful figure. He was an Olympic paddler. So the press, they just loved him, they adored him, but more for his look, his image, than his ideas, which were about emphasizing process rather than, say, a painting on the wall. So, and it's the same thing now. You know, there's so much emphasis placed on awards, the Giller Award or the Griffin Award, and yeah, maybe they have their place, but it just makes the lazy people lazier. So that a bookstore that doesn't really give too much of a care about poetry, they'll wait until the Griffin shortlist gets announced,
and they'll just
feature those titles, you know, what is it, 5 international and 5 local, that's 10 titles, and suddenly it's like, wow, they've done their bit, they gave it the office for poetry. Meanwhile, you know, Jess and I had invested
$13,000
in the poetry section at the St. Rosedale Library.
Yeah, I agree, you know, certainly with the idea of Canadian modernism being fairly imitative and uninspired form of modernism.
Maybe David Milne.
maybe with the exception of Quebec. And, you know, of course, there's lots of interesting modernism. But as a movement, you know, obviously, it's not as big. I don't think it was that big in the U.S. either, though. So, but anyhow, I certainly agree on that point. I think it's a huge, you know, problem. But it's hard to see anecdotally how those roots affect things. And, you know, the more obvious thing that I always, you know, noticed was what I was saying before about the total lack of distribution and the fact that this isn't seen as a issue relevant to Canadian culture because it doesn't involve actual Canadian products. So the idea is that if we dump money into Canadian authors and just kind of close our eyes, you know, our culture will just grow and improve, and, which is ridiculous since culture has always been international. And it's a kind of protective attitude towards culture that's that actually, you know, causes Canadian culture to suffer from a great deal of insularity and interbreeding.
Well, it's very CBC too. I mean, like, as yes. a community radio person, I have a lot of criticisms of the CBC, but if we're going to talk about, like, literary things, like the poetry face-off or whatever, the way that they treat independent music is really detrimental, really uninteresting, isn't promoting, like, interesting poetry or interesting literary things, and really is fostering the kind of stardom we're talking about, right? Like, fostering, like, us being really excited about Leonard Cohen and Margaret Atwood and being satisfied with that, right?
It's gotten even worse. A friend of mine, Joey Taylor, has created this wonderful concept called the six-string nation guitar, where he's taken, he solicited pieces of wood from all kinds of people, so that he's even got a little piece of the hockey stick that Henderson used to score that winning goal in the early 70s. You're too young to remember that.
Famous. But I know about the project.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, he's still trying to keep that going in terms of, like, letting famous people handle the guitar, have their photograph taken with the guitar. And he had in mind having a big concert on Parliament Hill. And all the events now that are happening on Parliament Hill have to be vetted by the Prime Minister's office, the PMO. People don't know that. It's true. All the cultural events now don't go through, say, Heritage or Canada Council. They go through the PMO. He's that kind of a fascist.
Yeah.